Monitor brings you the prize-winning interview program Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for the unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Senator Henry Jackson, Democrat of Washington. He is the chairman of a Senate subcommittee which this week began public hearings to determine whether the government is properly organized to meet the challenge of the Cold War. The committee's field of operations is as broad as the challenge of communism itself. This is the first review of our security policies since the passage of the National Security Act of 1947. The New York Times has reported that many officials in Washington regard the Jackson Committee hearing as one of the most significant efforts in many years. The list of witnesses has been described as a who's who of American organizational genius. In addition to questioning our ability to face the Cold War threat, Senator Jackson has frequently challenged our future capability to fight a sudden hot war. More than 4 years ago, he warned that the Soviet Union was forging ahead in the missile race. Senator Jackson is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Jackson, are Peter Hackus of NBC News, Edwin Dale of the New York Times, Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune, and John Steele of Time and Life magazines. Now, Senator Jackson, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Steele.
Senator, former Defense Secretary Lovett, this week testifying before your committee, recommended that ranking Defense Department officials be taken out of politics. What do you think of his recommendation?
I agree with the recommendation. I think this would do more than anything else to help improve the atmosphere here in Washington in the national defense debate. I think that we could have a more effective and a more constructive debate with that kind of approach on the part of the President of the United States.
But isn't this a political question, this issue of whether we should have more defense?
Very definitely it is a political question. It's a question that should be debated. I do not think, Mr. Steele, that it is in the interest of our security, however, to have secretaries of the various services making political speeches when they supervise professional soldiers who by tradition are to stay out of politics.
But Senator, is it not correct that your own party colleagues are running for the presidency on this very issue?
Well, of course they're running on part. That's one of the issues, sure.
Well, why shouldn't the other people have a chance to answer?
Well, they have a right to answer it, but Mr. Steele, I don't think that the Secretary of Defense and his subordinate secretary should go around making partisan political speeches.
Well, is their job not political? They're appointed as a result of a political victory.
Of course, they're appointed by the President of the United States, but I'm suggesting that this indeed is an area where we should do our best to remove any partisan tinge from the overall atmosphere that exists. Mr. Roosevelt did this prior to World War II. Mr. Truman did it, and I think it would help our overall effort.
Senator, are you going to recommend such a step to the president or try to get this underway, this unpoliticizing of our Pentagon people?
Well, Mr. Steele, I'm considering the possibility, at least, of introducing a resolution to indicate that it might be the sense of the Senate, that the Secretary of Defense and his subordinate officials not participate in partisan politics.
Mr. Drummond.
Just to deal with one point under discussion, Senator, have either of the two, in your judgment, have either of the two recent Secretaries of Defense been delivering political speeches? Wilson and McElroy?
Recollection was that the Lincoln Day address, Secretary Gates was to make a speech in Oregon, and the speech was released, but he got caught in a snowstorm or something, didn't get there. Does that answer the question?
Even the snow is on nonpartisan. I'd like
right.
to I'd like to...
Well, I'd say there have been mistakes made on both sides, but
yeah.
Two wrongs don't make a right, sure. And I'm just trying to suggest a constructive step.
I'd like to raise a question about your investigation of the machinery decision-making. A study. Now, without trying to deal with the merits of the administration's policies at the moment on defense and outer space and security, is it your judgment that these policies have been significantly affected by a bad policy-making machinery?
Well, I think that inadequate and poor machinery may have made it difficult to identify critical issues in time. It is my recollection, and I was quite active in this, Mr. Drummond, to give a specific example, that Mr. Eisenhower did not have an opportunity to have a full presentation of the requirements and the necessity of moving forward on an all-out priority basis on the intercontinental ballistic missile until the latter part of July of 1955. As a matter of fact, I wrote the letter as chairman of an Atomic Energy Committee in June 30th to be exact, 1955, recommending that he be thoroughly briefed and that this program be given the highest priority in the government. Now, this matter should have been brought to his attention earlier, and I don't think our mechanisms were adequate at that
Would time. You think that fact that the administration did not begin earlier than it did to emphasize the exploration of outer space and the whole Sputnik thing is related to this problem of trying to get the issues
Yes,
to the fore sooner?
I think the leadership is indispensable, obviously, but you can have the finest leader in the world, Mr. Drummond, and unless these issues are identified for him, that is, the critical issues, identified for him so that he can act on them, we're not going to get decisions in time. That's my point.
Mr. Dale.
Senator, I'd like to return to Mr. Steele's point here. Would you consider a speech by a Secretary of Defense or one of the service secretaries defending the decisions made by the department, defending the adequacy of our defenses as political
speeches? No, of course not.
That's okay. Then what, again, do you have...
Well, I'm merely suggesting this, Mr. Dale. We have a great tradition in this country that the professional soldiers, the men in uniform, are not to be associated
right.
with politics. I do think that there is a real danger that you place them in jeopardy. That is, we jeopardize this long tradition. I don't think that there's any sense at all, in my judgment, of having secretaries going around making partisan political speeches.
At, say, fundraising dinners?
That's right. I have, they certainly we want to debate this issue,
yeah.
but let's try to remove, I should say, the emotion, political emotions from the scene. I think Mr. Eisenhower has a golden opportunity now to take advantage of this situation and announce that the secretaries will not participate in partisan politics.
Well, now, Mr.
I
Lovett...
I think it would clear the atmosphere.
Mr. Lovett this week, in his very interesting testimony before your committee, said, among many other things, the only thing more dangerous than an external enemy is a group of homegrown military sycophants. And I am sure that he meant by that, or had in mind, a charge that has sometimes been made, and a rather serious charge, that in particular the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in this administration have been appointed because they agreed to begin with the administration's preconceived philosophy and were there simply to defend that philosophy. It is a serious charge. I'd love to hear anything you might have to say on it.
Well, I think there's been evidence of it. Admiral Radford testified in our air power hearings back in the summer of 1955 that he conferred with the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Humphrey, in connection with his duties. I don't think this is indeed the duty of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think his duty is to state requirements, indicate what the minimum requirements are needed for our survival, then it is for the political officers of the administration to make the decision.
The chairman under Mr. Truman, the last one, General Bradley, supported the intensely politically agitated question of our restraint in Korea. Do you consider that military sycophancy?
I do not. I definitely do not, because this involves this really new problem that has arisen in recent years of the understanding of international diplomacy and politics with military requirements. And I don't think that this is in the same field at all.
Mr. Hackus.
Senator Jackson, it strikes me that Robert Sprague made some of the most pungent comments before your committee this past week in indicting the present governmental setup when he said that both the president and his top advisors often are uninformed or misinformed. And I think he emphasized top advisors. Do you suppose he was including the National Security Council in this group? And if so, then would it be that the administration perhaps is being misled by its own top advisors?
I really can't go beyond Mr. Sprague's statement, because the statement has to stand on its own. I assume that there are situations in this complex machinery of ours that do not get to the President of the United States. I gave a specific case, a historic one, in the case of the intercontinental ballistic missile. It was late getting to the President. In other words, it wasn't until the middle of 1955 that this matter was presented to him on an urgent basis, although it is my understanding, and I, as I say, I conducted the hearings prior to that, that the Air Force had tried for a year to get this case to the President. Due to the complex machinery of our national security operation, it did not get to the President of the United States.
Well, now another...
It was invaluable time that we could ill afford to lose.
Another point that Mr. Sprague and your other witnesses have been making, they've been urging us to spend more money on defense, among other things, saying there should be more taxes levied necessary to pay for it. My question is, which politician in this election year is going to be bold enough to stand up and say, I'm for higher taxes?
Well, Mr. Hackus, I think the American people are deeply concerned about this problem. I think that a candidate who is willing to state that our requirements are not adequate, and that in the beginning at least, we're going to have to add additional taxes, will receive, I think, some surprising support. Sure, you'll lose some here and there. Everyone is against additional taxes.
Would you put it in the Democratic platform for 1960, or would you introduce a higher tax bill?
Well, I personally have stated before, and I will state again, that we need to add at least a minimum at this time of $3 billion to the budget, defense budget. I think that whatever deficit we'll have after we add that, we should make up in taxes. Then we should foster proper programs for economic growth so our economy can carry this additional load. This growth problem and the resource problem of supporting a greater defense effort is one of the areas that our committee is going to take a good hard look at. We have an interesting plan to deal with that.
Mr. Steele.
Senator, even before you started this investigation, or at the time you started...
Study.
Study or investigation, they're pretty synonymous, aren't they? You made a very, very sharp attack on the National Security Council, the President's top advisors in this field. You said the NSC presented a dangerously misleading facade, and you said that it spent most of its time reading papers that mean all things to all men. How do you know this?
Well, I'm aware of the operations of the National Security Council.
Their operations are top secret. How do you figure in on this?
I'm not going into detail on that, but if my statement is not correct, why, they can refute it. Truth is that the NSC is being confronted with a lot of problems that shouldn't be put before the NSC. I think they should only deal with critical issues. And like a lot of organizations, it's growing like Topsy and it's getting too big.
Do you get the NSC papers?
No, no. We have, I have a written understanding with the president that we will only deal with the machinery. And we have a right, of course, to know whether the machinery is working and whether it's cumbersome and so on. We're not interested in the substantive problems presented to the NSC, Mr. Steele.
Your hearings were undertaken, I believe, at the outset with a promise from President Eisenhower of his cooperation. How has he cooperated with you?
He's cooperated 100%.
In what way? In making security information available?
Oh, no, no, no. We have a liaison man with the White House that we're working with, and he has acted very promptly in connection with all requests that we've made. For example, Mr. Lovett's testimony in part was in executive session. I want to say that as of this very moment, the testimony is being released that he made in executive session. The White House concurred in every bit of it. There wasn't a word censored.
Has the president given you the results of the secret Gaither Committee report?
No.
Are you asking for them?
No. He, Mr. Eisenhower wrote a letter to Senator Johnson saying, or exercising his right of executive privilege.
Mr. Drummond.
Senator, I gained the impression a moment ago that you thought that the most knowledgeable people in the administration on defense and security affairs ought not to expound administration policy in an atmosphere of partisan politics. Now, if I understand you correctly...
Well, Mr. Drummond, I just want to say that I don't think it's even good politics for them to do it. I think that they hurt themselves when they...
critics of the administration's defense policy expound their criticism in an atmosphere of partisan politics. And are you going to have only one-way disclaimer of...
Wait a minute. There's a vast difference. As a member of the United States Senate, I take an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution places a responsibility on me to provide for the common defense. Now, do you mean that I shouldn't ask questions and debate this?
You're not saying that the spokesman of the administration shouldn't expound administration policy, but only not expound it at political gatherings.
I'm saying that the Secretary of Defense and his subordinate secretaries who supervise career military officers would be wise in not going around making partisan speeches. It's that simple.
Who then is going to answer the attacks that are made on them?
Well, I want them to answer the attacks, but do they have to make a Lincoln Day talk and do it? They can do it. They can do it. They have an opportunity to come before Congress and do it if they'd stay in office long enough. Problem is that they're only there for a short time and they're gone. They're not there long enough to answer a lot of these questions.
Question.
Someone's briefing them to get ready for the next question.
I occasionally have gained the impression that Congress likes to study other people a lot more than study themselves, in one sense. Now, in reading your 20-page interim report, I thought I found that you devoted about one out of those 20 pages to the need of reorganizing Congress to deal with the problems of survival. Is it your thought that the need of reorganizing the executive branch is about 20 times more urgent than that of reorganizing Congress to do the same thing?
Mr. Drummond, you know that under our system of government, the administration of these programs and policies in the executive branch of the government, obviously, they have 95%, they have all the administrative authority. Now, Congress is not immune from blame. I think we have too many committees dealing with national security now. That's why in the report we call this to the attention of the public. And I do think there is a need, Mr. Lovett or Mr. Sprague, I believe it was Mr. Sprague, who recommended that there be a Committee on National Security. I think there's a lot of merit in this contention. I think it's unfortunate that the administration has to come up and appear before so many committees. Now, one way to help it is to consolidate their effort. When they consolidated the armed services to a certain extent, that is, they eliminated the Naval Affairs Committee and the Military Affairs Committee, and we had one committee, the Armed Services. Now, if they make some consolidations in the executive branch, I'm certain that the corresponding change in committee setup will occur in the Congress.
Mr. Dale.
Senator, Mr. Watson, another of your witnesses this week, made the very controversial recommendation that we must somehow avoid the type of public debate on defense policy that confuses the country. Surely, the ordinary reader of the papers in the last 6 weeks is inevitably confused. What is your view about this?
Well,
should General Power say his views or just Secretary Gates before the public?
Well, I think what Mr. Watson had in mind, and I hesitate to speak for him, I want to say that he was a very able and a very fine witness. He's a little concerned that where decisions have been made, the military, that is the professional military people, continue to debate the issue.
Right.
This is indeed a troublesome problem, because if an officer comes before one of our committees and he's sworn to testify to the truth, he's guilty of perjury if he doesn't give his honest professional judgment if we ask it of him. This places him in a very difficult position. I would certainly agree, once there's a decision, we should try to have support for that.
But
I do think that the military people have a responsibility to properly advise the Congress as to professional requirements for our defense.
Then you would not have Mr. Watson's suggestion adopted, that in effect the debate be conducted behind closed doors, or to the extent it's in Congress, in executive session, and then everybody support the agreed decision.
Well, no, I think I would hope that some of this debate can be more in executive session. There's been, for instance, recently here an awful lot of confusion that I don't think was necessary.
Right, and a last point, the story in the paper this morning is that the administration has appointed, without announcing the same, a truth squad to answer some of the contentions of the critics. What do you think of that idea?
Well, offhand, it does smack a bit of a propaganda squad. It almost sounds like a partisan squad, because the last time the term truth squad was used was in connection with the activities of the Republican National Committee. As I recall, in one of the campaigns, they had a truth squad following Mr. Truman around, trying to tell him what the truth was all about. And if the president would let the American people know what the true defense picture is within the limits of security, they wouldn't need this propaganda group over in the Pentagon.
Mr. Hackus.
Senator Jackson, if you can't believe, as you say very often, you can't believe what the top man tells you, the president, who would you suggest that we, the American people, should go along with? Should we take a general's criticism, a senator's viewpoint, or a collective viewpoint somehow? How does the American public know what is the truth?
Well, I don't want to say that we shouldn't believe the president. The president should state the situation and let the American people decide. He can give his judgment. But the president has not disclosed, as he did, as I recall in his speech here a few days ago, anything about the missile picture vis-a-vis the Soviets. This he did not do, and this is a crucial question. Well, I would say, Mr. Hackus, that we're in a situation now where one can argue from now till doomsday about the number of missiles we have, the number of missiles the Soviets have. I should only like to make one suggestion. It's very simple. Why take a chance? We know they have an intercontinental ballistic missile. We know they have many. If we err and find that they have many more than we anticipated, then they have the capability of destroying us. I don't think we should take that kind of risk. And by having an invulnerable deterrent, one that can be there even in a surprise attack, Mr. Hackus, I think this is the best insurance we have for peace. This is the way to avoid a general atomic war.
This criticism is very similar that you have among a number of Democrats in Congress. Is it possible that some of this, at least, if not a majority of it, is purely politics? And taking it a step further, there have been those who've said that perhaps you yourself might be thinking of winding up as a Democratic vice presidential candidate and that this might help the cause. Well, when can we expect your announcement?
Well, Mr. Hackus, you've been around the political scene a long time. You know that we don't run for vice president. I'm not a candidate. If they want to nominate me, I'll accept it. I'll anticipate your next question. I'm sure there's going to be politics in this thing. Anyone who says to the contrary is just not being frank. There's bound to be some. I'm suggesting that we remove as much as we can of the harmful aspects of it so that we can get honest debate so the public can make some decisions.
Senator Steele.
Senator, as a vice presidential candidate, who would you like as your running mate?
Well, now, I haven't been nominated yet.
Well, you're running. Mr. Who do you want to run with?
Mr. Drummond, short.
Well, that's a very flexible program that I have.
As a student of the machinery of government, what do you think of the machinery by which both parties nominate their presidential candidates?
Well, I am afraid that while the primary system sounds wonderful, I can't conceive, at least maybe but a few people, who can really run in all of the primaries if all 50 states had them. It's just too
Senator,
much money.
Senator, I'm sorry that I'm going to have to interrupt. I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Senator Jackson, for being with us.
And our thanks to Senator Henry M. Jackson, Democrat, Washington,